rated M for mature.
Welcome to the Lost Pages of Norse Myth. I'm Jason Weiser, your narrator and host of the Myths and Legends podcast. Each month, join us here as we reveal a missing page from the Prose Edda, the great book that contains all of Norse myth. It is whispered that these lost pages tell the story of a god from a distant land and his young son as they embark on a perilous journey across the Norse realms. I present to you now the sixth lost page, A Call from the Wilds. Even before he opened his eyes, Atreus knew he wasn't going to like what he saw. For one thing, he was moving. Fast. Carried by something that was rocking his body clumsily back and forth. The sensation was not unlike what he imagined sailing must be like. Being thrown this way and that, at the whim of the waves. But Atreus had never been sailing. In fact, he had never wandered further than the woods immediately surrounding his home. There, he knew every tree, every path, every inch of the forest. But as he strained to open his eyes, he saw the treetops above him rushing past. He recognized not a one. His eyes opened now. Atreus confirmed that he was not being carried by the waves, but by his father, Kratos, who was rushing him through the unfamiliar wilds at impossible speeds. As Kratos' face came into focus, so did something else. Pain. Sharp, hot, and damp. The boy touched it and felt the warm blood running from the fresh gouge on his arm. Blood, pain, panic, none of this was familiar. Atreus' stirring caught his father's attention, and the god looked down at his son. "Boy," Kratos barked, "look what you have done." Kratos' tone was gruff, short, and full of disappointment. "At least that," thought Atreus before he slipped back into unconsciousness. "Seems familiar." That morning had started like any other. Atreus woke to find his father already gone, off on one of his daily hunting trips. But why claiming an elk for dinner, something Atreus' mother and he sometimes practiced over a matter of hours, took his father from dawn till dusk almost every day, Atreus never understood. Atreus spent the morning sharpening his arrows and his skills. His mother reserved a good part of each morning teaching the boy Elder Futhark, the runic alphabet of her people, and Atreus was a quick study. He could read and write on his own now. But Atreus had yet to experience the true power of the runes firsthand. His mother had only recounted tales of the battling gods, shouting runes aloud to trigger all manner of magical attacks. The boy often fantasized about how exciting it would be to have this edge in a real battle, something his relatively quiet life hadn't remotely given him the opportunity to test. As the sun rose high in the midday sky, Atreus sat in the branches of a nearby tree, listening to the sounds of the forest and allowing his mind to wander. Since he was small, Atreus had displayed an ability. Nothing as formidable as his father's vaulted strength, but Atreus' gift was extraordinary just the same. Sometimes, the thoughts of others intruded upon his own. He couldn't control it. But often, when animals or other baser beings were in distress, Atreus could hear them inside his head, like eavesdropping on a plane most in Midgard didn't even realize was there. On afternoons such as this, Atreus liked to close his eyes, see how far he could listen, and imagine what adventure might lie in the Norse wilds, past his familiar woods. He listened to the song of the wind blowing through the reeds, and of the trees, heavy and cracking under the building frost. But as he craned his head to attempt to hear even further, something else began to creep at the edges of his mind. A voice, crying out in pain. Atreus sat up in a shot. The voice was as clear as it was desperate. Not a whisper in his ears, but a shout in his mind. The cries were not in the language of his mother's people. They were simpler, more basic and animal than that. And although Atreus didn't understand the words themselves, he did understand their clear intent. an animal was in pain and reaching out to him for help. Atreus knew it was dangerous to wander too far out into the woods. His mother had told him so his entire life. But faced with the choice between ignoring another in pain or risking his own safety and the consequences for disobeying his mother, the boy chose the path he knew in his heart to be one of honor. Atreus wasn't a coddled child by any means. He was, after all, raised in the unforgiving wilds of Midgard. And a boy his age was expected to at least be able to handle himself during an afternoon excursion. So, when Atreus grabbed his bow and quiver and told his mother he was off to practice his aim, she was already immersed in her own warrior's training and thought little of it. His feet crunched the frosted ground as he trotted off in the direction of the pained voice. Running now, he glided and vaulted easily over familiar tree stumps, twisted roots, and jagged rocks, whose position he knew how to navigate as easily as finding his way in his own cabin in the dead of night. The pained cries of whatever poor creature was reaching out to him had grown louder now. Atreus tightened the straps on his quiver and quickened his pace, flying past the woods and trees he knew and towards adventure. Atreus hadn't noticed, but as he ran, he had passed one certain tree adorned with a yellow handprint the size of a woman's hand. The three middlemost fingers of the print were clustered together, with the outside finger splayed out like wings to resemble a soaring bird. With a call in his mind to guide him, Atreus made his way through unfamiliar terrain, attempting to study the patterns of roots erupting from the ground to use as makeshift path back home. He imagined himself as one of the fabled gods from his mother's stories, traveling to distant realms on the roots of the great tree, Yggdrasil. He was brave Tyr, mapping the unknown for the good of all the realms. He was mighty Ull, on a hunt for honor and glory. He was lost. Completely and hopelessly lost. So caught up in his imaginings had Atreus been that he had forgotten to keep track of the guiding roots. The woods seemed now to be a repeating maze of indistinguishable trees, rocks, and terrain. Had he taken a left at that last jagged boulder, or... Atreus's growing panic was sharply interrupted by screams of agonizing pain. And something else, something darker, growled at the edges of his mind. The wounded animal was near, and in real peril. Forgetting his own dilemma, Atreus blindly shot forward toward the cries of the beast. And there, in a clearing, he saw it. A doe, the largest Atreus had ever encountered. It lay on the ground, wounded. The matted, blood-stained fur on its chest, heaving up and down with struggled breaths. Atreus approached the great animal and inspected its wound. An arrow still jutted out of the beast's neck. Some careless hunter had felled the animal, but neglected to finish his work, leaving the doe to struggle alone. Atreus knelt before the animal and looked her straight in the eye. The doe's pained grunts, which had been constant, eased now. Its eyes contracted in recognition. The one she had been calling had come. "You're safe now. I'm here," Atreus comforted. "You can let go." The animal's breath became quicker and shallower. The doe took a final breath in and then moved no more. Atreus laid his hands on the doe's heart and softly recited the Norse rites of death his mother had taught him. Atreus sighed. As he stood next to the fallen doe, he noticed that the animal's fur was not the only bloody surface. The ground around the animal was also stained red. Too much so for a simple arrow wound. In fact, the blood wasn't a pool at all, but a trail leading off into the brush. The trail led Atreus around a bend, and then he understood. The blood did not belong to the doe, but to the hunter, who now lay in pieces at Atreus' feet. Atreus' stomach rolled as he took in the scene in front of him. The doe was one thing, but this death wasn't the clean, purposed result of a hunt. This death was brutal and grotesque. He had always thrilled to his mother's descriptions of the fury of mythical monsters. But the horror that lay before him was almost too much to look at all at once. In the glances the boy allowed himself, the strewn body parts, the unnatural, savage cuts through muscle and bone, the film that was already forming on the pools of blood, all of it burned into Atreus' mind. He never wanted to see anything like this ever again. Atreus' only comfort was the thought that, thankfully, he wasn't here to witness this terrible scene unfold. Atreus held his breath in an attempt to allow the nausea to pass. And that's when he heard something else. Something that had been hidden by the dark forest mere steps from the boy, still breathing. Atreus desperately tried not to look, but his eyes betrayed him. As they rose to the trees beyond the body, Atreus saw them there lurking in the darkness, close enough to reach out and touch. Atreus recognized the creatures from his stories. They were one of his favorites, and also the ones that kept him up the most. There, in the woods, standing and breathing just as heavily as the terrified boy, stood two rotting corpses, heaving, vile, undead creatures of pure rage. Draugrs. Atreus' eyes widened as they met the empty sockets where the larger Draugr's eyes were supposed to be. The creatures roared and charged. Atreus grasped blindly at his quiver, pulling an arrow but losing his footing in the process, crashing to the ground, his bow and remaining arrows scattered across the frosted earth. The Draugrs rushed closer. The larger one reached his prey first and plucked Atreus from the ground with both hands. The creature lifted Atreus so that the boy's face met its own. Atreus recoiled. The stench was unbearable, and that was before the Draugr bellowed, spraying particles of rotten teeth and decaying gums over the boy as the monster's half-tongue flayed blindly and horribly, like the death throes of a headless snake. Atreus screamed in terror, shutting his eyes and turning away as best he could. His right arm pushed back against the Draugr's face, his left hand still clutched the arrow he had pulled. And in desperation, he stabbed out with it again and again and again. By pure chance, the final stabs managed to pierce the translucent skin over the exposed part of the Draugr's skull, and the arrowhead found the creature's soft brains. Atreus was still screaming and stabbing, even after the Draugr had dropped him to the ground, where it now lay in a heap. The boy needed a moment to catch his breath, a luxury the second Draugr was not about to offer as it lumbered nearer and nearer. Eyes wide in horror, Atreus dared not avert his gaze from the nightmare before him, but managed by feel to reach down and grasp his bow and another arrow. Quickly stringing it, he fired, and the arrow embedded itself directly into the Draugr's shoulder, separating it from the rotted muscle of the creature's arm. If the Draugr noticed the damaged arm, now hanging grotesquely from the tendons of his shoulder, it didn't show it. The arrow did nothing to stop the monster lurching closer to Atreus and raising his blade. Panicked and gasping for breath, Atreus found and strung a third arrow. This time, he pulled the bowstring taut until his arm burned. He released. The arrow flew through the air and exploded against the Draugr's sword, shattering the blade into pieces. "Yes!" Atreus exclaimed. But his celebration was short-lived, as his direct hit had unintended consequences. Quicker than the boy could react, a shard from the Draugr's sword flew through the air and sliced his arm, causing the boy to lose his bow once again. Atreus yelled out in torturous pain, but as the Draugr lurched even closer in for the final kill, Atreus felt not frightened, but angry. Blinding pain turned to white-hot rage as his ears pounded and his vision glazed to pure red. As the creature bellowed with fury, so did Atreus. Two warriors, with nothing left but anger and pain. The last thing Atreus saw before the world went black was a ghostly white hand reaching down and grabbed the Draugr by its throat, cutting its tortured scream short. A small, quiet question escaped Atreus' lips before he fell unconscious. "Father?" Father and son were rushing towards home. Kratos saw his son was now awake and slowed his pace, lowering his son to the ground and allowing Atreus to stand and find his legs again. "Your legs carried you here. They can carry you back." "I don't know the way," Atreus blubbered, holding back his tears. Kratos only grunted. "Find it then. It is getting dark." Atreus nodded and trotted forward. As he led his father home, following the twisted tree roots, he grimaced at the still fresh pain on his forearm. His father noticed. "The cut is deep. It will heal, but you will carry it with you." Atreus smirked. "My first battle scar."
"It is no trophy," Kratos barked. "It is a reminder. Your luckiest scar is all your carelessness brought you. This world is dangerous."
"Not for you," Atreus protested.
"Show me. One day you might need me."
Kratos considered this for a moment.
"I need you today,"
started the god, as he ushered Atreus to quicken his pace.
"To talk less and walk more."
The sixth lost page has been revealed. Step into Atreus' shoes, explore more of the Norse wilds, and unlock up to 8 pieces of collectible God of War art by playing A Call from the Wilds, an original God of War messenger adventure game. Find it on Facebook, and keep listening now as we chat with God of War's story leads about the creation of Atreus.
So you guys just want to introduce yourselves and talk about what you do in the game?
I'm Matt Sofis. I'm the story lead.
I'm Richard Gobert. I'm senior narrative designer.
So even before this game starts, why did you feel there was more to Kratos' story after God of War 3?
Well, after God of War 3, we felt like we took the character as far as we could go. And I say this as we, because I wasn't on the Blast project and neither was Rich. So they were done with him, so we figured, hey, we have a toy to play with. Kratos had gone kind of as far as he could in the Greek pantheon, literally by killing off pretty much all of them. I think Corey, when I came onto the project, Corey kind of talked about where he wanted the character to go and that, like, he was in a different point in his life and so was Kratos. And I think Rich and I are both fathers of young sons as well. So it all kind of just meshed together. And it just felt like that was the right place to take Kratos as well, because we could write well from that perspective. And it was a side of Kratos that people hadn't really seen. And they knew he had been a father before, but there wasn't a lot of time spent in that in the Greek pantheon. So this was a chance to explore that.
Yeah, and I think people are constantly reinventing themselves, especially after traumatic events or any life-changing events. And why not let Kratos do it as well? I mean, you could argue that he's an irredeemable character because he's done some fairly terrible things. But you could also make the argument that he did redeem himself at the end of God of War 3 by sacrificing himself to bring hope to humanity. So we should give him another chance.
You mentioned his first family, and he tragically and famously lost them. How does that impact his view on his new family?
For a lot of this game and for a lot of the stuff that happens before this game, Kratos has always been really, really good about denying his past and trying not to take responsibility for his actions. And so it colors everything he does with his son and with his new wife. He doesn't want to remember that, and he doesn't want to repeat the mistakes of his past. So he thinks, like a lot of people, like a lot of us do, if you don't think about it, if you don't talk about it, then it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And that causes harm to his son, and it causes harm to himself because he's not actually dealing with it.
Right.
He's having trouble moving past it, and so he'd rather forget. I think he's even said that in previous games before. He would rather forget. That's all he wanted to do, right, was just make me forget. That was a lot of the deals that he made.
And because he's felt that loss before, I mean, he's never going to allow himself to feel that again, or he's not going to let anyone do that. He's going to protect his family at all costs.
And protect himself.
Yeah.
So he definitely, so he makes a change of scenery. What brings him to Scandinavia, and what's his mindset going there?
Where we kind of left God of War 3, you know, we have kind of time jumps that happen over the course of time. And in my mind, and kind of the backstory in my mind and that we've talked about with Corey and among the three of us, you know, at that point, Kratos was a pariah. He's not welcome in Greece for the destruction he caused. He destroyed practically the world around there, the Greek world there. And so, like Rich was talking about, needing to change, needing to find a new place, he goes north. He has kind of a choice to go south or north. It's kind of the same. It's kind of the same thing that we chose as a development team is the choice to go south or go north, and Kratos went north.
Yeah, he arrives very broken. He's a very broken man. You know, he's walked the earth for countless years. He's lost his mind and gotten it back again. But he's hit rock bottom when he gets to Scandinavia. And so getting there is kind of a chance to start again.
And he's not looking to do anything more than escape his past.
Okay.
When he gets there. He's not looking to find love or have a family or anything like that. He just wants to go to a place where he can cause no more harm to anybody else, and he can just not be bothered by the world. I think when he gets to Scandinavia, he fully expects to live out whatever years he has as an immortal, which is kind of forever, just live out the rest of his life in solitude.
Yeah, isolation is what he wants.
Unlike the previous games, it's not focused on revenge. What motivates him this time?
I think deep down, Kratos doesn't believe he can be redeemed. I think we use that kind of as a reflection of what a lot of people feel about the character. And based on the things he does, it's kind of a natural extension for that character to not think he can be redeemed. So when he takes this journey, when he takes kind of this very personal journey with his son in this game, it's really all about, with Kratos, he's focused on what they need to do, you know, on just the day-to-day, the hour-to-hour, minute-to-minute. Okay, this is the goal ahead of me, we're just going to achieve it. This is the goal ahead of me, we're just going to achieve it. And I don't think that Kratos really thinks too much about what they're doing other than I have a goal set in mind, I'm going to focus on that goal, and then we're going to go back to being isolated and alone in our forest.
Yeah, I think maybe subconsciously or on some level he does, you know, he has fears of how much of him is in his son, how much of the bad is there. And I think because they've been estranged and he doesn't know his son very well, it's an opportunity to see how screwed is this? How screwed up is this kid? How much have I screwed him up?
Yeah. Kratos has, we've established kind of in our backstory for the setup to the game, Kratos has largely been an absent parent. He hasn't been like gone. It's not like he's, you know, some guy who lives off in the woods who comes around every once in a while. He lives with the family, and he believes if he can just focus on I will provide for my family, if I can bring skin, I can build, you know, a house, I can bring food, then that's enough. Because like Rich said, he fears the influence that he could have on his kid. He's already passed the bloodline, which is bad enough. The last thing he wants to do is pass his own influence onto his son. So he largely leaves the raising of the child and his outlook on life and how he approaches situations to the mother, while he just focuses on I'm going to provide the basic necessities so we can survive.
He definitely seems like a different character from before. How different is the playable character? Like, how will it feel for people who've played previous games?
He's the same Kratos fundamentally, but I mean he is different. You know, it's a much more, while the story is still epic, very epic, the main spine of it is very intimate, and it's very personal, and I think that carries over into other aspects of the game. I mean, the combat itself is much tighter, it's much closer, it's much more intimate. I think it just feels much more...
Immediate,
yeah.
Yeah.
To play as this Kratos.
Yeah, Kratos, in the gameplay, I mean... Anybody who's seen any of our releases, our E3 releases, can see that the combat is incredibly different. And we're retaining the DNA, right, of the God of War franchise by keeping the action fast and powerful and impactful and sometimes very brutal. But he's a changed person. We're changed as developers, as we've kind of grown up. I think I've heard Corey say it a lot, where he's grown up since God of War 2 to now. And so I think what we've tried to do is, while Kratos is brutal in kind of his efficiency and he's going to take the quickest path to taking down an enemy, it's not, in essence, in a way to be gratuitous, right? He's not like, he's not relishing in it like he did before, where he was just this, he was filled with rage and vengeance and he was taking it out on anything that got in front of him. Now it's more a means of, they have to survive in this very harsh place to survive. And he's going to do whatever it takes to get through the object that they need to, that's in front of them.
How did the idea of Atreus come into play? Like, how early on was that something that always, that you always wanted, or?
That was something that came on, very early on for us, because when we joined the project, Corey said, "Hey, that Kratos has a son now." So it's been so early that like it predates either of us being on the project, and Rich was here a year before I was. So I think Corey's been pretty open about the fact that when he came back to do God of War, since he now had a son and he had a different perspective on life, the way that Kratos used to be, the way he would kill things and the way he approached situations, it didn't mesh with who Corey was at the time. And it doesn't mesh with who we are now at the time either. So I think Atreus was a way for ending up being all of us to kind of borrow from our past, borrow from our experiences, and bring that into God of War, like it or not.
Yeah, and to process what it is to be a parent.
Yeah.
You know? But
and to constantly fail.
Fail.
Did Atreus the character always kind of look how he does right now, or how did his look and his character evolve since you joined?
At one point, Atreus started out, I mean, the early concept art, it was always in kind of this ballpark from what I saw. Mm-hmm. It varied from him seeming a little bit darker as a character to something a little bit more full of life and innocent.
How did you decide on the age for Atreus?
That was very tricky.
Really?
Because he had to be old enough that he could do the things we needed him to do. He needs to be involved in combat. He needs to kill sometimes. And if he's too young, it strains credulity. But you also didn't want him to be too old, because you want to preserve that sense of innocence in him. You want him when he's at a crossroads of who he's going to be. That's very important. And I think, you know, part of why Kratos, I think, wants to be on this journey as well, is because he can have an influence before it's too late.
That's interesting, because he like feared that influence before. That's cool. How is Atreus different from Kratos, and how is he similar?
Well, from the obvious gameplay perspective, Atreus is just from their weapons, right? Atreus is a bow. He's a more ranged character. While Kratos goes in there, well, he can throw range because he can throw the axe and recall it. He's the guy who gets into the thick of things. But from an emotional standpoint, the kid basically having been steeped in the mother's outlook on life believes that there's good, and that there's good in all kinds of things. And the kid even believes that there can be good gods, where this is a point of contention with Kratos, right? Kratos doesn't believe that any god can be good, especially himself, right? So I think something that we had always believed, that gods were kind of a thing that you didn't talk about in the house, or at least especially not worshiping them. I mean, the mother would talk about the gods of that realm, so the kid kind of gets this, he's the point of view character sort of in some aspects, but he's also the encyclopedia for the player in a lot of ways in our game, where Kratos never wanted to know anything about he just wanted to be alone. He didn't care about other gods. He didn't care about anything else. He didn't even care to learn the names of the things that he would fight, right? The kinds of creatures that he was out there fighting. he would realize that guy is, you know, got a lot of, got fire and lava stuff inside of him, but he didn't know necessarily that the thing's name was a Draugr. Because he didn't care about that sort of thing, but the kid does. The kid carries a lot of the knowledge in the game. He can read the languages, which Kratos can't. He's the emotional core where Kratos is the detached one.
Right. I think they make up for each other's emotional deficiencies. You know, they kind of complete each other in a way.
So you mentioned Atreus was raised by his mother. What aspects of her character helped shape his personality?
I think she also influenced him in that he's much more compassionate than Kratos is. And he gets that from the mom. Yeah. He's sort of the moral compass at times. And again, all of that came from her.
Yeah, the kid often throughout the game will have a desire to help various characters or creatures or whatever that may need it. And he often asks if they can help. And Kratos is pretty much every single time says, no, they don't stop us. So they don't matter. They're not our concern. Kratos is always focused on their goal. Well, the kid wants to experience the world. This is the first time the kid is really getting to leave their woods. And so there's this kind of huge, stranger in a strange land for Kratos in the sense that, you know, well, I mean, he lived his whole life in a different place and now he's come to this foreign land. Well, for the kid, his entire world was the woods. And so now he's being exposed to all this stuff. You see the world serpent in the E3 2017 awesome. Trailer, right? Where the kid freaks out and is excited and things like that, where Kratos just wants to go, am I going to have to kill this? Yeah. Right? So the kid has this innocence that Kratos doesn't. The kid has a curiosity that Kratos doesn't. And I think that kind of, that all stems from the mother.
You mentioned the mother helped shape him. What role did Kratos have in shaping him, or did his absence shape him?
Oh, I think his absence definitely shaped him. More than his presence. I think there are probably some basic things that Kratos taught his son. Like I can imagine Kratos teaching him how to use a flint type thing to make fire. You know, the basics of how to survive in some aspects, but it's really his absence. Kratos would go off for days and weeks and things like that to go out and get materials that they need. And there's other stuff that he would try and do to contain his own rage and learn to get past it that Atreus and his mother never really even knew about. But the son, Kratos not being there made the son feel like Kratos didn't care about him or was disappointed in him, right? Especially with the being sick and you see Kratos and Kratos is this just completely jacked guy, even in his, you know, as an older man. So I think just his father not being there was enough to shape him into that. Well, I don't want to be like him, but I think this happens with a lot of kids. He's always seeking to try and get Kratos' approval. He's trying to get his dad to love him in ways that he doesn't understand that Kratos already does.
Yeah, that absent dad is very powerful, especially because when he was there, he's not a talkative guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, Atreus is going to fill in that silence. He's going to fill that in with things that probably aren't correct, but to him, he's going to feel shame. He's going to feel like his father doesn't like him. I mean, he's physically, he's very different than him. Emotionally, they're very different. But he wants to please so much. It's sad. I'm tearing up right now. I'm not actually.
No. He has no feeling. He's more like Kratos.
When you were shaping the character, was there anything that you wanted to avoid when you were shaping Atreus?
Oh, well, like, I think with any child character, the biggest thing to avoid is making them annoying, right? There are infinite number of examples of kids in film, not as many in games, but there are some in games where I think we kind of went in with the idea of if we can make the kid just be generally likable, you know, then we'll have already succeeded. And then if we can make you really, really care about the kid, then we really succeeded. But the main thing was just not ever getting too yippy, right? and certainly not getting too bratty unless like the story really called for it in that moment.
What did you guys take from your own lives as fathers when you were developing that dynamic between Kratos and Atreus?
There's always the question of how much do you let your child see of you? How much do you allow them to see who you really are? Because part of it as a teacher is you want to have that wall. You need to have that wall so that they take things seriously. But it also feels wrong to withhold yourself because you want your child to know who you are. So it's always a delicate balance because they can't know you entirely. An important element of being a parent is that how much do you show of yourself to your child? You have to be a teacher, and sometimes that means that you put up a wall and you have to have that formalism there, but you also don't want to deprive your child of knowing who exactly you are. So it's always, it's a delicate balancing act, and I think we were all hoping that we could kind of reflect that in the story.
I think Rich and I are, I mean, we're both big softies with our sons. I mean, you have to be able to discipline your son, and you have to be able to put up that wall, but we both show levels of affections to our son that Kratos doesn't. So a lot of times when you're writing Kratos, you're going counter to what you would do, obviously. We had like famously several times through the development of it was actually our first playable, but our first playable kind of became the E3 2016, where the reactions that we were getting from the beginning a lot with Kratos was like, I would never treat my son like that. And that was like, then we are on the right path. Because we wouldn't treat our sons like that either. And if anybody treated their son like Kratos, then they're not a good dad. But with Kratos, it's kind of easier to step into those shoes when you have a son of your own, because you have to, unlike Kratos, you want to be their friend. You want to show interest in what they do and who they are and everything like that. But I think we can all kind of relate to fearing that we're not doing enough to guide them to where they need to go, fearing that the bad aspects about ourselves are going to seep into who our children become. And when you have a son, it's kind of very easy to see that reflected as a father. I see with my son all the time, him saying something and I'm like, oh, he got that from me. And like Kratos at that moment, I'm like, you should be more like your mother.
Yeah, I have a son too, and I see that all the time. It's, with like the wider Norse mythology theme, did you take any inspiration from children in Norse myths or from like pop culture or anything? Like what was sort of the inspiration?
No, I think we wanted to add a new character, you know, that would be our contribution to Norse mythology would be these two new characters who are kind of crashing the party. So we deliberately kind of stayed away from basing him on anyone from Norse mythology.
It's funny because in Norse mythology, it's not like Greek mythology where there are just tons and tons of documents and books and things like that from the era that it happens. And there are literally encyclopedias of Greek gods and Greek heroes and things like that. Whereas with Norse mythology, you know, outside of kind of the big four or so, people don't really know the Norse gods and heroes and things like that. And just in general, it's harder to find. It's, you know, they didn't have a language that they didn't really write down things. It was more like Native Americans, and that their myths and things like that were spoken through stories. It's sometimes hard to pull from Norse mythology because it's, you know, their depictions vary very wildly. And then on top of that, Corey really wanted to go into this and really flip everything on its ear, you know, flip the table on what people expect of the characters that they know. So, Atreus really kind of became We didn't really pull anything from Norse myth from Atreus, other than, you know, some of his abilities and things like that. But yeah, mostly he's kind of our own invention as far as in attitude and things like that.
As I was asking that, I was like, there aren't actually like a ton of kids in Norse mythology.
Yeah,
it's like all of Norse mythology fits in like a novella.
Yeah, like a novella. And the only one that's even right now popping into my mind is Skadi, right? Who's like the giant daughter of Thjotse. I don't think I'm pronouncing that right at all. But like that's the only one that's even popping into my head as a kid.
I like that kind of idea of adding to the mythology because like mythology back in the day, like folklore is like this living, breathing thing. So it's really cool to kind of bring those aspects into this new medium. Did you think about that at all when you were starting on this game?
Well, you know, it's tough because there's a lot of room in there to play because things aren't as spelled out as in other mythologies, but
it's both freeing and paralyzing.
And paralyzing at the same time, and you want to be respectful to the original myths and not deviate too much, but if you do that, then you can't tell the story that you want to tell, so.
Yeah.
I think we, seeded throughout, we touch on aspects of Norse mythology. But yeah, like, I think because so much of it is, you know, Norse mythology largely is told through the lens of a Christian who wrote about it something like 1,000 years later. So, you know, we have a lot of room to play. We fold in a lot of the things that are accepted that come from kind of the prose Edda and the poetic Eddas. But yeah, it's like Rich said, we try to pay respects to things. We acknowledge lots of things that are accepted through both stories. We have things called like lore markers and things like that you read that you pick up these different aspects so that people can kind of get a dummy's guide to some of the Norse mythology stuff. I'm not saying at all that any of our players are dummies. We're the dummies in this case, where we're having to like look up various sources. But largely, you know, we just, unlike some of the previous God of Wars, since Kratos is in this different place where we're trying to keep things more intimate and really about a story about a father and son, the myths are the backdrop, but the core of the story is a very personal, timeless story.
And then for people, when we do make deviations, for the people who do know the myths, you know, there's a little bit of a twist in there for them. So hopefully that will buy us a little leeway.
Now, I understand what you meant with the dummies thing. Like for players who are like uninitiated, sort of like with that wider culture, for them, is Atreus, since he's new to this world, does he kind of function as an in for the player? Is he like the lens through which the player?
It's funny because both Atreus and Kratos sometimes serve that role. Right.
I think if you have not played the other games, the kid is the viewpoint character that you're getting to know Kratos through. And if you know the other games, it's the flip where you're trying to find out who this kid is through Kratos.
Yeah. And both of them largely, Kratos deliberately so has not learned about the world. So he's learning about the world as they go through it just by virtue of the kid going, oh, mom talked about, you know, this person or this says, you know, whatever.
Whether he wants to know that stuff or not.
Whether he wants to know that stuff or not. Yes. Oftentimes Kratos does not want to know and he doesn't care. You know, the people who are curious, you know, who I think the people who are curious a lot of the times, while Kratos serves as the point of view of the receiver of the information, you know, the son is kind of their point of view character because they want to know more about things. For people who want to just cleave things in half, then Kratos becomes the point of view character a lot.
Was immersion important for you in developing this game? Because it seems like you kind of are taking the viewpoint in some way of Kratos. Like you don't know the language, there are these runes, and you have to have things explained to you.
Yes, I think immersion has been been threaded throughout, through all kind of aspects of the game's development, both in the aspect of how Kratos sees the world, to the new camera that we use in the game as you follow cam rather than the third person
camera,
the fact that we're doing no camera cuts, and you know it's a seamless experience in the cinematics. It's a handheld feel rather than set stage shots. All of that was kind of important to try and keeping the player in the world and feeling like they're in it the whole time. And not giving them a breather to get out.
So what aspects of Atreus' character do you think players will identify with the most?
He makes a good contrast to Kratos. Kratos can be, he's very rigid, and because of that, he can be a little ridiculous at times. And I think it's okay to feel that because you see it through the kid. So it kind of makes it okay. I think two people will identify with him because he is sort of the moral compass for both of them. I think he's sweet. You know, he's a sweet kid. I think people are like that.
Yeah. I think fundamentally we all want to believe that people by their nature are good, you know. We have evidence of the contrary at various times, but I think we want to believe that people are good. And that's what the kid kind of represents. That's his outlook, that people can change and that not every situation is something that needs to be hit like a freight train. Whereas Kratos is obviously the other side of the equation, and he has lots of evidence that supports his viewpoint. So, I think that aspect of the kid is something that people, by and large, can identify with. And if they don't identify with it, then they can certainly identify with Kratos' point of view.
Well, guys, it seems like a really good mix of like an epic yet really personal story. So I'm really excited about it. So thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and talk to us today.